The following Noble Path talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
So welcome, everyone. It's a beautiful day out there. Thank you for coming here. Thank yourselves for coming here on this late spring day. So as Tenfu said, my name is Chikyu. My Dharma name is Chikyu. I live here in Brooklyn. I'm married with a daughter, 23-year-old daughter. Live about a mile away, and I've been practicing here since 2010. And Hojin Sensei invited me to give this talk. She is on a well-deserved vacation, and she'll be back in the coming week. So this morning I'd like to talk about two ways of sort of being in the world, what I'm calling being and doing. On one level, I think the distinction is helpful to talk about, especially as I find myself often caught up in what I call doing mode. Maybe you can relate to that. But on another level, this distinction is just a viewpoint that can be helpful, but only if we don't get too caught up in it. So I want to look at how these two modes play out in our personal lives and then see what the implications are for the greater world we share together. So you might have heard the phrase, we are human beings, not human doings. I've always liked that one. And yet we find ourselves constantly on the go, doing. I should be clear at the outset that there's really nothing wrong with doing. Where would we be without doing? I'd be naked and hungry in my backyard. I don't know about you. So all of our doing has brought us some pretty great things, gains in healthcare, technology, standards of living, you name it. And yet there's this side of doing, what I'm calling doing mode, that I feel I get caught up in. I get caught up in my head, sort of cut off from my body, sometimes using as doing as a way to distract myself, or locked into a view or an opinion, an outcome that really isn't helpful. When I do check into my body in doing mode, I'll notice that it's tight, holding on to a lot of stress. You know, this may be an energy that you know too, maybe you can connect with. You know, if you sprinkle in a little caffeine, perhaps it's how we power most of our days. But is there another way? Is there another way to be in the world? I tend to think of being and doing as two separate things, almost like being versus doing. Is this true? In many of the koans we hear teachers talk about on these Sunday mornings like this, there are a lot of examples of doing. A monk will ask a master some version of the question, what is Buddha nature? Or what is enlightenment? And the master may respond by simply drinking a cup of tea or eating from their rice bowl. Or there's that koan where a master asks his students to raise the blinds. And as the students do so, he says, one has it and one doesn't. What's going on here? How is the master's tea drinking any different than my tea drinking or your tea drinking on a Monday morning? What's the difference between the two students raising the blinds? I'd like to share a poem by David White called Enough that for me is a nice example of being. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. So what's getting in the way of our enough? Why do I feel I'm getting caught up in doing? There are a couple of elements of this doing mode that I want to explore here. Busyness and attachment to outcome. Busyness for me is a kind of distracted doing. This is anything from checking work emails to endlessly reading the news to getting caught up in social media. There's an absent-minded quality to this, almost like an autopilot. What's driving this? I recently shifted from full-time to part-time work for an organization, and this has forced me to look at my work schedule a lot more critically. I only have a few hours for this organization's work, and yet I find myself responding to one more email long after the time I said I was going to stop work. And these are not exactly time-sensitive emails, but you know that just one more email kind of feels good, right? That one more email, that one more swipe, that one more article that really isn't shedding any new light on a terrible news of the day. Perhaps you've seen the documentary, The Social Dilemma. In it, we see how swipes and likes tap into the reward system in our brains, giving us a hit of dopamine each time we swipe. The same can be true for other productive behaviors like emails or completing tasks on our to-do list. Am I the only one here that gets a lot of pleasure out of scratching things off my to-do list? Perhaps you can relate. On the face of it, this isn't really a bad thing, right? You know, nature got it right. It really is a great thing that our biology rewards us for a hit of dopamine every time we do something productive. The problem is that like all addictive behaviors, the pleasure starts to wear out. If there's too much dopamine, we can start to feel stress and irritability. So there really is too much of a good thing. And we basically flooded ourselves with an endless number of things for our attention to grab onto in search of the next stimulation. So in terms of this busyness aspect of doing mode, I think the dopamine hit is driving some of this feeling of getting caught in doing. But there's something more to this busyness I see. There seems to be a distracted quality, a quality of turning away from something or not really accepting this moment, wanting the next thing. If I tune into it, there could be a base level of anxiety underneath it all. As I do this with my hands. Anybody relate? So when writing this talk, I first misspelled busyness with an I, which is business, which I thought was interesting. I don't know why it took me decades to realize that. I think I did realize it a long time ago, but probably buried that. So anyway, I looked up the origins of the word business and found that it is connected to busy. So in Old English, busy or busic means careful, anxious, busy, occupied, diligent. And business means care, anxiety, occupation. So isn't that interesting? Built into the definition of busy is care and anxiety. We tend to work on things that we care about, but what's up with anxiety? What's the relationship between care and anxiety? Seems we tend to get caught up with, or we tend to get anxious about things we care about. Our health, the health of a loved one, our reputation, good standing, not looking like an ass giving a talk in front of your sangha. So what's your relationship between care and anxiety? Do you find these two things closely related? Can we care without feeling anxious? What is care without anxiety? What is doing without anxiety? In this practice, you might have heard, pain is part of life, but suffering is optional. Pain is a sensation in the body. Suffering is what we do with the mind. Anxiety is natural also, but is it optional? As I mentioned, I see a level of distractedness in my busyness. What happens when the mind is distracted and unfocused? Well, there's a part of us that is conditioned to scan the environment and look for threats and problems, an early warning system that kind of runs in the background. This is handed down to us from our very successful ancestors that survived living in the savanna, scanning their environment for threats and not getting eaten by giant animals. We also know that a distracted, unfocused mind tends towards worst-case thinking. The mind likes replaying our worst hits. It's like anxiety sort of built into the system, if you will. Is there no relief? What happens when we come back to the breath? What happens when we bring our minds back to the present? Mindfulness in Sanskrit means to remember. Remember what? To come back to the present moment. To come back to practice. When we put our attention to the breath, we calm the nervous system. And bring our mind back to the present moment diverts it from replaying its worst hits. So where is the anxiety now? But mindfulness is not always easy. I notice a sense of inertia in my life that maybe you can relate to. When I'm in doing mode, my mind tends to seek out more doing. If I have a really busy morning and sit down for lunch, my mind is still going. It'd be very difficult for me to resist picking up my phone. Or even want to stop for lunch, actually, for that matter. But what do we know about inertia? An object in motion tends to stay in motion unless another force is applied. So this is where a moment of mindfulness can change that momentum, can shift that inertia. Joshin last week talked about constancy. And I agree with her in two important points. Yes, constancy does sound like a Victorian virtue. And yes, it's really important to my practice. If I have a level of constancy in my practice, it's easier for me to break the inertia of the busy mind with mindfulness. The farther I move away from my constancy or practice, the more difficult it will be for me to come back to mindfulness and break that inertia. So what is underneath our busyness or distractedness? I'll sometimes catch a glimpse of a negative thought or belief or viewpoint underneath it all. It could be a negative thought or feeling running in the background. I'm carrying from an earlier part of the day, perhaps a conversation, a difficult conversation with a loved one or a colleague. I'll think I moved on from it, but I probably haven't. And somewhere along the way in my busyness, if I slow down, I'll notice that it's kind of there, some sort of feeling. And there's also more general feelings of perhaps lack or self-doubt or pessimism. Those negative beliefs or thoughts that we developed early in life but don't really want to see. This might be underneath our busyness too. Seeing these views is really helpful. It gives us an opportunity to bring them to light, to study them, and care for them if needed. Hojin Sensei introduced me to a good practice when confronting a belief or thought that's a little sticky, that doesn't want to go away. Ask yourself, is it true? When I see a viewpoint of self-doubt, for example, I can never give a talk in front of the Sangha. I'll ask myself, is it true? I find it's just an opinion, not really grounded in any reality of the moment. Like all thoughts, empty, able to come and go if we don't really cling to them or push them away. But some of these views of ourselves can go pretty deep. I find practices of self-compassion to be really helpful with these more deep-rooted feelings and opinions. We have this amazing ability to be our own wise inner parent, to care for those parts of ourselves, those parts that have opinions, that exert their opinions on ourselves, and care for them. Thich Nhat Hanh says to speak to these feelings just like a parent would talk to their child. Oh, my dear fear or insecurity, I see you. You're okay. There's something so kind about Thich Nhat Hanh's voice that if you've heard it, kind of replay it in your own head. Thich Nhat Hanh's voice saying, "It's okay, my dear fear and insecurity, you're okay. You can sit here next to me during this talk." And here's a little PSA moment. Shoan Osho gave a lovely talk on views last week. So if you haven't heard it, it's not yet up on the podcast, but I assume it will be soon. So I suggest you check that out if you're interested. So an important first step with these views is to see them. This is where periods of increased practice through retreats like half day or full day sits, or the one continuous thread or sessions are really helpful. Helpful for me, at least. Really helps me to see kind of what's under the radar of my everyday. Maybe things that I've been trying to avoid. Since we're all home dwellers here, I want to say a little something about these one continuous thread retreats, especially if you're new. You might say that this is one of the fruits of the pandemic, these retreats. So every month at the monastery, they do a week-long silent retreat called Session. And during the monastery, they decided to open that up. So the lovely qualities of Zoom allowed us to Zoom into the monastery. And so one continuous thread retreat is really up to the practitioner to make their own schedule at home. So you're welcome to follow the retreat schedule of the monastery at your house, or you're able to kind of tailor it to your own needs. So me personally, I start my days with the monastery, and I end my days with the monastery, and I work in between. I try to sit maybe in the afternoon. I also limit my social media, my sort of socializing, things that sort of I naturally gravitate towards in my busyness. And I really find the one continuous thread practice is just appropriately named. How do we continue our practice throughout the day in those pieces that we may want to miss? So what would a meeting, let's say one of your team meetings, be with a little bit more clarity and practice? What would your day be like with those inevitable problems that pop up in your life, be with a little bit more practice and stillness? And perhaps what might you see in your own busyness with a little bit more practice and stillness? So we have all this busyness and distraction keeping us away from our life. But there's also this other quality of doing mode that for me gets in the way of the enoughness of this moment. And that's this attachment to outcomes. Perhaps you can relate to that. So this attachment to outcomes, which we might consider a manifestation of the attachment to self. How much of my doing is in service of the idea of the perfect outcome and the praise that will come with it? How does this get in the way of just drinking tea? I remember when I was young, maybe 12 or 13, I was painting something at my house. Not actually like a painting, but painting a wall or something. You know, I haven't really thought about this in years, but when I was writing it, it popped into my head. I don't really know I was even painting this thing. Anyway, the whole time I was painting it, I was fantasizing about how the father figures in my life, my dad and my uncle Mario, who lived next door, who was an actual house painter, were going to respond to my painting. And I just had this fantasy that I kept going back to over and over and over. Like, they're going to be so surprised and they're going to love it. And I couldn't get it out of my head, you know? Even at a young age, I saw like, it's kind of ridiculous and a little bit embarrassing, actually, to be having this fantasy. And so I'd see that, and I'd be like, I'd kind of come back to my painting, and then I'd find myself in the fantasy all over again. I couldn't really control it. And guess what? The fantasy didn't really play out. The men in the village didn't all come around and congratulate me and declare me a man from that day forward. I do think, though, there has something to do with a chapter somewhere down the line of patriarchy and, and the male initiation rites of patriarchy in suburban New Jersey in the 1980s. Maybe another time. But how much of that continued and continues to drive my doing today? You know, I find service positions here at the temple to be really helpful for that. You know, I first was given one of my first service positions. I was doing it like I do everything else in my life, which was tight and tense, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to be great at it. And it didn't take long for me to figure out, like, wait a second, that's not the way to do this. That's how I do the other things. Isn't that kind of what I'm trying to move away from? And again, one of the lovely things about a Sangha is there's a level of trust to allow yourself maybe to just be with that practice, with what's coming up. And that doesn't mean that those thoughts don't arise. That doesn't mean that there's no nervousness in it. But can we let that be, kind of flow through us and not get too attached to it? So that's a plug for if you're ever tapped on the shoulder here and say, can you do this or do that? Just say yes. So attachment to outcome and praise, fed by the desire of the ego to be seen, to be recognized, to exist. How does this get in the way of just drinking tea of enough? This is not easy to let go. For many of us, we've built up our identity through what we do. So it becomes so much more important for us to want to control the outcomes. Our society in particular places a lot of emphasis on productivity. If you multiply my attachment to productivity and outcome by hundreds of millions or even billions of people, you get a world focused on output and growth and moving us beyond our planetary boundaries. So there's another reason why I think about doing and being. Our way of doing things is fueling the planetary crisis we face. Some of you who have been part of our environmental work in the Sangha might have heard me talk about my work with the Mindful Rebels. It's an affinity group of Extinction Rebellion that uses meditation as a form of protest. In a society that tells you that your self-worth is in what you do, it can be a radical act just to sit meditation and not do. The Mindful Rebels sit meditation in front of financial institutions around the city on a weekly basis, going on almost 2 years now. Our message for them is to stop financing fossil fuels, but really the Uber message is to slow down. Come back to your relationship with yourself. Come back to your relationship with others. Come back to your relationship with the earth. Once in a while, we'll have somebody kind of come by and mutter under their breath, get a job. Which is kind of funny because we actually schedule these sits before work or during lunch or after work because we all have jobs. Like, who can't really have a job in a society? So I've been sitting in this group off and on for a couple of years now, and many times as I'm on my way to a sit, I'll find myself filled with self-doubt or a sense of futility. But it never ceases to amaze me how that settles and transforms during the sit. What happens when we sit? What opens when these views are allowed to pass through, like so many feet busily walking on their way to this or that? Some of us in a Sangha over winter took part in Ecosattva training. I see some Ecosattvas here in the audience. This was an 8-module course that applied the Dharma to working with the climate and ecological crisis. So how do we work through our own fears about the crisis and attachments to what we think are successful outcomes to actually show up and respond to the reality of the moment? In the training, they shared a framework for how to respond to the metta or Pali crisis from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship that, as I find, is sort of another manifestation of being and doing. The framework suggests to structure your activities into three categories: block, build, and be. So what is it in this world that we want to block? Systems of harm and injustice. What is it we want to build? Community, reciprocity, care. And how do we be? Being is how we nurture all of that. So in a world where it's easy to see harm being done, our first inclination might be to go out and do something. But if we just do without the being work, we're more liable to repeat systems of harm that underlie a lot of the problems we face today. So I have a second PSA, which is that the environmental group will be coming back again soon. So check your emails, check the newsletter, and we're going to be rolling out, working with that framework, the build, block, and be framework. So keep your eyes open for that, and I hope you'll join us. So I heard of this concept of polarities. Maybe you've heard it too. So sometimes we think of things that we might think of as separate, like being and doing, but they're just sort of polarities on the same axis, right? Being and doing. Doing and being. So there's practicing and then stepping forward to block. And then there's practicing and stepping forward to build. Back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth. And if we do this, perhaps there's less separation the more we do it in this continual action of being and doing. There was one teacher in Ecosatva training that really resonated with me named Dr. Larry Ward. I think some of you resonated with some of you as well. He said, the energy we need to transform our world comes from awe, from a connection to or an experience of the absolute. This is where joy comes from. Joy transforms. And through this joy, this breath, these words are enough. So I want to close with a poem. From here to there, carrying that weight, take rest. Who is it that's so preoccupied? This was inspired by something that I saw in a temple in Kyoto years ago. I started my day with meditation and breakfast and went out to explore the temples of Kyoto with some clarity and stillness. But by midday, after visiting a few temples and plans to visit some more temples by the end of the day, I was in full doing mode. I was alone in a small, secluded temple and came upon two Japanese characters over a doorway. I looked down and saw the translation. Take rest. Find where you are. I needed that. I sat. So as I recall, the characters were a gift to a priest of the temple in the 16th century. What a gift. Take rest. Find where you are. Can we give ourselves this gift of mindfulness, an invitation to come home?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.